Hey, what's good, everyone? This is Rich.
And I'm Marcus.
And you're listening to Paychecks and Balances, a weekly podcast covering work and money for millennials and beyond, where we strive not to bore you to sleep.
And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at PayBalances and on Facebook at Paychecks and Balances, all words.
And of course, if you've been enjoying the podcast and want to hit us with the 5 stars on iTunes and tell potential listeners what you think about the show, be sure to subscribe and leave us a review in Apple Podcasts. If you're on Twitter, the best thing you can do is share the show with your network, and we've made that super easy. All you got to do is go to paychecksandbalances.com/lit. I don't like how my lit came out, but I'm going to go with it, and hit send. I'm going to really regret publishing that.
If we reach more people, we help more people. Y'all know how it goes. Tell your friends, your mamas, your cousins, your sisters, your ex that you're trying to stun on. You let all the people know we're just trying to get out there. And today we're going to be joined by Donna Friedman. Donna is the author of Your Playbook for Tough Times, but she's come back with Volume 2. The original was Living Large on a Small Change for the Short Term or the Long Haul. Volume 2 looks at needs and wants. Donna has over 20 years of experience writing about and helping people with personal finance for media organizations like MSN Money and online publications, including Vox Media and Get Rich Slowly from our former guest, J.D. Roth. That'll be in the show notes. And thank you for joining us, Donna.
And let's get into it.
So welcome to the show, Donna. Any other updates between writing a whole other new book while I'm over here struggling just to write a blog that you'd like to share with the listening audience? We had you on in November 2016. Anything that might have transpired since that time?
Well, as you said, the new book came out at the end of May, and I'm struggling to write a blog, too. I'm making a living as a freelance writer and making a living as a writing coach and teaching people how to write on my writing course. But other than that, not much else going on.
Yeah, I feel like whatever my credibility was, and I struggle with that over the years, but like all these tweets, like the micro blogging has completely ruined my ability to write anything more than a paragraph. Like I'm exhausted. I'm like, oh, you know what?
141 characters. My God, I'm exhausted.
How could anybody do this for a living? So, yeah, which is weird because I could tweet for 8 hours a day, you know, fire off 105, but I can't put together 1,000 words anymore. It's like a real effort. So the struggle is real.
It is.
So the new book, Your Playbook for Tough Times, Volume 2, Needs and Wants Edition. And I want to open up by depressing everybody, but I think it's an informative fact. According to a report from the Federal Reserve, 52% of U.S. residents would be unable to come up with an emergency $400. Why is that? Yeah. Why is that?
Well, a lot of reasons. There's persistent underemployment, which I think is a huge issue. Underemployment. Oh, I've got a job, but all it does is cover the basics. And if you are a young person who has student loans to pay back, for example, that's going to eat up a chunk. If you've got a car payment, that's going to eat up a chunk for the next however many years. So you keep thinking you're going to save an emergency fund, and yet where's the money? You know, at the end of the month, you look at it and say, well, maybe next month I'll put some money in there. And as an aside, the new book, I offer to send the chapter of my old book for free, the one called 33 Ways to Save an Emergency Fund, Even If You Think You Can't. And that's true for your readers, too. If they want to email me, and you can put this in the show notes, email me at survivingandthriving@live.com. I will send anybody that chapter for free, no strings attached, because that's how much I believe in emergency funds.
So from that list, I guess, what would you say, and I guess if you know off the top of your head, what would you say are probably the top couple of things?
To make the reasons people can't save?
Yeah.
Stagnant salary. You haven't gotten a raise in however many years. The cost of essentials keeps going up. Rent, of course, in some places is insanely high. Gasoline, if it goes up 5 or 10 cents a gallon and you have a long commute, that is going to eat a huge amount out of your carefully hoarded money each month. Underemployment and unemployment, of course. And I think still student loans, I think they're eating people alive. Mm-hmm. And you can't negotiate them. You can't say, well, I'll just move to a cheaper apartment. Well, you can do that, but you can't say, I'll just move to a cheaper student loan. Not going to happen.
It would be an interesting conversation. You know, it's funny you say that, because, and I was actually writing another piece along these same lines, and I was kind of trying to, you know, now I have to think back. I'm literally at that point where let me reflect back in time, because about 10 years ago when I started getting into debt, and even now when I, you know, purchased a new car, I underestimated the cost of a vehicle. So I you know, I just share that with the folks. Even like, I'm in this lane, I'm in this realm, I've been practicing these positive habits for coming up on a decade now. And it wasn't just the car payments, but I also think to that point, which is, you know, technically a flexible one, it was is a choice. I don't regret it by any means, but trying to guess what's going to happen. So my loan is 66 months, and the first month was free. So I'm trying to, I'm like, okay, I can afford this now, but I also have to assume I can afford it for the next 65 months.
Right.
And there have been changes during that time, as you might imagine. So for whatever that's worth to the people, you know, gauging that window of time that you'll be paying for the thing, whether it's a car loan, a student loan, there's just a lot of unpredictability that even I didn't account for.
Yes.
Gas being one of them too. I think that thing, the way I drive it, gets about 8 miles to the gallon.
Yeah, luckily, sure.
Luckily, gas is cheap right now, and I'm continuing to pay for that.
Right. But insurance too. If you're a young male in this country, you're also going to get hammered by car insurance. But some of your readers might be thinking, well, yeah, maybe that is why I have more months than money, because I'm a 25-year-old guy with student loans and a car payment, and I have to pay car insurance. Well, yeah, no wonder.
Yeah. I don't throw in any maintenance or anything like that, and it gets expensive super fast.
Exactly.
Yeah, I will, you know, tell the people, oh, yeah, parking is, and that's another thing. I think I was unfamiliar, because in Denver, I used, for those who like, I use public transportation 90% of the time. So I just completely, I think, for about 5 years of my life, underestimated or forgot how much it truly costs to drive a vehicle day to day. And I mean, to some people, that will sound crazy, because they drive, they sit in traffic for hours at a time. They're like, yeah, everyone thinks of this. I'm like, no, everyone does not. I can tell you, because I'm one of the everyone. So what inspired, or were you always looking to write the sequel? Was it listeners? Was it readers? What brought the sequel on?
Well, I had written the book very long initially, and a couple of people in the public relations, listen to me, the personal finance field people said, that's too long. You will scare people, because you're telling them, look at these 40 things you should be doing. And they think, I can't do all those. And they shut down mentally. I can't do that. So they said, cut it in half at least, make it shorter, make it more easy to grasp, and then give them a sequel, then they can build on what they've learned. Also, I don't charge a lot for the books. Some people are charging $16.99 for a book the size of mine. I'm charging $9.49 and less on Kindle. So I thought, okay, I can turn this into two books and still not feel like I'm ripping people off.
Nice. So one of your quotes, or one of your questions, was, shouldn't people just be smarter about money? And we touched on a little bit here. What circumstances are people facing that seems to either be unique to this generation, or I think I like how you're saying that it's a lot of these personal finance experts seem to, it's your fault. You've done something wrong. It seems like you've taken a different stance.
Even if you have done something wrong, we can't go back in time and retrofit the past with smarter behavior. We can only change what we do now. And, you know, if you did take out huge student loans without any clear idea how you'd pay it back, well, it's too late now. Now you just have to learn to get smart about repaying them. But I think a lot of young people, again, were sold that bill of goods. Oh, everyone takes out student loans. Go to your dream school. But those guidance counselors aren't going to be there to help you pay it back. So you're stuck with heavy student loan debt, and you maybe graduate into an economy that isn't giving you the salary you thought you'd get in your field. And there's the issue of medical costs. Most young people are healthy, thank goodness, but a lot of them aren't. And in small ways, even if you just slip and sprain your ankle, you were talking thousands of dollars for emergency room visit, you know, the x-rays, the doctor looking at it, the doctor poking it, the doctor taping it up, giving you a prescription for painkillers. That can take out your emergency fund right there if you don't have health insurance. I think that if you're born into a low-income household, it's going to be two or three times as hard for you to get ahead because you don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. So these are issues, I guess, that have come on with every generation, but student loans, I think, are a particularly bad situation for young people.
Now, I remember when I was in school, and this was a pretty common thing for me and friends, and I would see everyone do this, where we wouldn't really need to go get that extra student loan, but we wanted that refund check.
And so yeah, we wanted to live on it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, to go do fun things, to go do reckless things. And it was pretty easy for me to get a hold of that money. I mean, I think I went into the office, I made some sad puppy dog eyes, and they were like, here's $5,000 more. And I'm like, great, like free money. So Do you think that schools have a responsibility to be more stringent when it comes out to handing out these additional student loans, that where students are then using these checks for more kind of discretionary reasons versus necessary reasons?
You know, I don't think you can make people not take the money. I mean, I don't think you can tell them, no, we're not giving it to you across the board. I think that if you make them sit down and look at a student loan repayment calculator quickly with them and say, if you borrow this money now, here's how much more you're going to pay back over the next 10 years. Like they do with credit cards. They'll say, if you charge a pizza on your credit card and you pay only the minimum payment each month, it'll take you years to pay off that one pizza. So you'll end up paying 10 times the amount the pizza actually cost. Now, again, young people aren't always willing to listen to that. What they're hearing is, you're telling me I can't have this money, but my friends are all going to Europe for spring break, and I want to go to Europe for spring break, so give me the money. But I think that if you put it in terms of, you're already going to be paying this much back per month for 10 years, adding three more of these will make you pay this much back for 10 years, and all before you really know you have a salary, but it's still going to be due. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't think you can make people listen, but I think you can at least scare them a little. Mm-hmm. It's scary, though, how I spoke with a professor of psychology, and she said some of her students didn't even know the extent of their borrowing. And when she would say to them, that doesn't concern you at all, and they'd all very confidently say, it doesn't matter, I'm going to get a good job when I graduate, I'll pay it all back. Yikes.
Yeah, and that's what I thought. And, you know, I've had good work situations. You mentioned that part about showing a loan calculator. And I remember when I would go in and ask for those additional refund checks, I never saw anything like that. I pretty much just had a conversation, gave some reason why, and then they were like, okay.
Here's some money.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's pretty much how it worked. So it's interesting to hear that, because that was not my experience. And that's probably why, or part of why, I acquired as much student loan debt as I did.
Those calculators are available online, and anybody who wants to do that, well, maybe with a younger sibling who says, I am totally going to go to Penn State, it doesn't matter how much it costs, I'll pay it back. Run the numbers with them. Are you really prepared to pay this the instant you walk out the door? It may not make a difference, and it might make a difference.
Mm. It's interesting you said that about the credit cards, and I'm wondering, I guess we can talk about it, although I don't know how much influence we have, but it took a federal mandate for that. So the annual credit report, and I'll put this in the show notes, folks, don't start ripping out your pen and paper or smartphones. I was looking it up here. I don't have the exact law in front of me, but it was a federal mandate that required that breakdown of how much a pizza will cost you on your credit card. Do y'all think that's what either may be coming or what we'll need at the student loan level? So same thing with, cigarettes, where they have the this thing that you're about to put in your mouth may kill you. Do you think that's the kind of warning that we'll need on student loans in the future?
Pause.
I think that they need to be more transparent. If they aren't already, I have not taken out a student loan since I was 18 years old. And that's years ago. That was a long time ago. When I went back to school in my 40s, I did it without loans. I got scholarships and grants, and I really beat the bushes for grants, scholarships, and other special things. For example, I got a fellowship for the summer, and they paid, for 2 months, they paid $1,800. Mm. To go. They paid my way through it. It was the university fellowship. But they also paid us $1,800 because the idea was you would not work during those 2 months, and the stipend was to help keep you going. Mm. They wanted you not to be working 40 hours a week and also attending the fellowship. So that was, I won't say that was luck, because I looked for that stuff pretty hard, and I got a lot of unusual, odd things that I found and used. But if I were taking out a student loan, I would want somebody to explain to me, yes, this is how it works. I have read of parents who have signed for PLUS loans and didn't even realize it. Their kid gets the letter that says, okay, congratulations, you've been accepted to state school of your dreams. And here's our first year breakdown of your student aid. And again, that psychology professor said, some of her students said, well, I have student aid. And she says, well, how much of it is a loan and how much of it is a scholarship? I don't know. So parents will come in with their kids and to the school office, and the school says, okay, you have to sign these series of papers. They're not reading them. They don't understand that they just signed a Parent PLUS loan. They just know that their kid, the first one in their family to go to college, is going to college, and all they have to do is sign these papers, and it happens. So then later they're on the hook for loans, and they never even realize they signed up for the loans. Don't sign anything without reading it. But yes, they need to be really, really transparent. If you borrow $10,000, it's going to, at this rate, it's going to take you X number of years and X dollars per month. But remember, you may be borrowing this amount next semester or next year. So if you borrow $40,000, it will take you this much per month, this many years. That might help a little, because when the students realize, wait a minute, $800 a month, every month, 10 years, maybe they'll think twice.
Right.
Rich, I hope you're jotting this down in Silicon Valley. I think we have an app here, by the way.
There's an app for it. The other thing I want to bring up about loans, if I may, it isn't just can I make that payment, it's the opportunity cost of that money. If you had gone to a more manageable school and your student loans were $200 a month or no loans at all, what could you have done with that $800 a month every month for 10 years? What's that, $96,000? What could that money have done for you other than pay for 4 years of education and, yeah, having fun? That's a lot of opportunity cost.
That's so poignant, because I've heard stories from people who they wanted to go to this prestigious institution. They went there and then they didn't graduate. And them not graduating didn't make those loans go away. You know?
No, correct.
So you know, I know people who have literally hundreds of thousands of dollars of student loan debt who didn't graduate, you know, which is kind of crazy to think about.
Goodness. But another thing for people who are listening or who have younger siblings, go to a different school for 2 years and then transfer to Dream School. The diploma says Dream School. It doesn't say community college or state college. Then Dream School. It says Dream School. It doesn't matter where you go for 2 years. So, and you'll save a ton of money in the meantime, especially if you can live at home.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense.
This isn't the college loans hour, but that's one thing I always love to point out to people. Yeah, it doesn't matter. What matters is where you finish, not where you start.
Exactly.
Well, that is true, but I think it's all interrelated. I'm definitely something I've gained an appreciation for. I mean, that debt being debt. I mean, I was telling a story recently, trying to bring this all home, about my credit card debt. And I realized that my free money was credit cards. And Rich was talking about this before, because I only had one minor student loan for about $3,000 for my final semester. But I was spending my free money on credit cards. And I remember my friends were sitting beside me spending their free money on student loan refunds. And now we're all 30 something years old, still paying these free money contributions off. So I think it's really all the same. It's all debt.
Way to bring it home.
I appreciate it. I had a really tragic, I don't even know if I want to share this. I was crunching the numbers again right now while y'all were talking, besides writing notes vigorously, because this is a great episode. And I was talking to my cousin yesterday. So he's 34, or excuse me, he's 35 now, I'm 34. And you know, Rich, where you have these, you know, these what ifs. And he was like, man, how much money do you think we spent on alcohol? And I was joking. I was like, $250,000. And he's like, nah, man, that's impossible. And so I started, you know, first of all, divided by two, multiplied by 10 years, probably 18 to 21. It was $500 a month. And I looked at it, and I go, man, we've spent $500 a night on multiple occasions. So, yeah, I actually think if you want to depress yourself, folks, you might want to just imagine how much money you've spent on alcohol over the years. Like this stuff, it adds up. It's like that opportunity cost, that deferred cost. And speaking of which, because people hate it so much, excuse me, my philosophy on budgeting continues to evolve. That's actually why I was exactly having this conversation, because I'm trying to trying to think how to help people who probably don't even know they realize or realize they need help. They're already drowning. So how do I point out first that you're drowning and then second what to do about it? Do you think the emergency fund is the save all be all? I know it's kind of the cornerstone of the personal finance advice, but I heard some interesting advice recently from a gentleman. I'll find a New York Times article. He's like 28. I've saved $750,000. You know, one of these guys, you know, I'm rich and you can do it too. But he said that he only maintains an emergency fund of about $1,000, and he puts the rest in interest bearing low index fund accounts. So he has a really minor emergency fund because he assumes that, you know, I just won't be laid off, which I know is the whole point of an emergency fund. But do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I think another point of the emergency fund is simply to take care of minor emergencies that can eat you alive, such as a car wreck, but even just minor car repair. Anytime the hood goes up, I automatically think $500. It's going to cost $500. Now, that's if you don't have it and you don't have credit, how are you going to get to work, right? I mean, you have to pay for the car. Or if one of your kids breaks his glasses, okay, well, it's going to be another $80 or whatever kids' glasses cost these days. So another $80. It's the little nickel and dime things that can kill you, frankly. And that's an emergency fund doesn't have to be huge. Liz Weston, who you know now writes for NerdWallet, but she's written a bunch of books. She said even $500 can make a huge difference in the average person's budget. If you have a $500 emergency fund, it will get you through a lot of the little ones. If one of your kids gets strep throat, say, that's going to be a doctor's visit copay of probably what, $35, $40 plus a prescription, plus maybe you had to take a day off work to be home with them till they were able to go back to school. Having that money there will make a huge difference. I'm looking madly here for my notes here. There was a study in the Urban League did about emergency funds and low-income families. Okay, here it is. Mm. The Urban Institute, rather, not the Urban League, savings between $250 and $749 for lower-income households. Pardon me. Families who saved were 24% less likely to miss a utility payment, 28% less likely to miss a housing payment, and 78% less likely to be evicted. The problem being, of course, I've got my rent money together, and then my kid breaks his glasses, or my kid gets really sick and I have to run her to the doctor. Okay, well, I don't have any other cash. I have to take it out of my rent money. Well, my rent's going to be a week late because I don't get paid, and then they're going to charge me a late fee. So I'm behind the eight ball already for next month, and so on and so on. Do you see what I mean? Or I can't make the light bill and pay for the strep throat medication. I'm going to have to pay for strep throat medication. Of course you will. So then you're late on your payment, and then the utility gets kind of cranky with you, or maybe even shuts you off if this has happened before. So yeah, have even $250 to $500 can make a huge difference. And again, I will send that How to Save an Emergency Fund chapter for free to anybody who wants it. And I have sent it out because people are emailing me and say, yeah, I want that chapter. So yeah, I mean, it would be great if they bought the book, but I'm more interested that they save an emergency fund. So yeah, I'll send them that chapter for free.
And the dental cost is something else that people don't think as much about. And I remember we had Erin Lowry on from Broke Millennial, and she talked about that. And over the past few months, as I've been getting things fixed because of irresponsible things that I've ate, or I guess it's probably not so much what I ate, but what I did after I ate those sugary and sweet and delicious things, or didn't do. And how quickly dental costs can add up, you know, and I've actually considered, and I'd say actually even at this point, aside from my flexible spending account at work where I put aside, you know, a certain amount pre-tax, I've also started creating a little bit of a dental fund for anticipated dental work, because it seems like it's one of those things where, you know, for people who are working and they have that benefit, it's not a big amount that comes out of their paycheck usually. You know, it's usually one of the smaller numbers. But when you have something like that come up, you know, a kid falls and breaks a tooth, or you chip a tooth, or, you know, suddenly you have a rotten tooth, that can easily be a $1,000 expenditure right there. you know? And so that's one of those other things that, that people need to think about when they're kind of setting these funds up, you know. It's kind of like, you'll hear people refer to it as having like issue fund, you know, versus a financial cushion fund. And so, you know, that's something that, I've thought about. And is that something that you also recommend for people, you know, where, yes, it's important that you have this emergency fund, which is kind of your cushion, but should there be something else that you're trying to set aside as well to kind of deal with some of those other things that may come up?
Well, yes, you can. If you have an online bank or even some other banks, you can create a sub account or a separate account and name it dental costs or new car fund or whatever you want to call it. A lot of people don't even have dental insurance through the work. That's the other thing. They may have bought themselves insurance on the marketplace, but they haven't bought dental insurance. Mm. And they think, I don't have any problems with my teeth. And then they get the root canal issue, and it's thousands of dollars, you know, to get that done. Now, some offices will let you finance it through one of those agencies that gives you pretty much 0% financing if you make the payments. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, if you have to go to a dentist, there's something called healthcarebluebook.com, and you can look up various types of medical issues by zip code, and it'll say dentist A will charge you this much for a root canal, dentist B will charge you this much for a root canal. You can look at things like that and then try to find the best deal. Of course, you want to check out the dentist and make sure that he isn't, you know, Dr. Payne. Then when you go in to get the work done, say, do you offer a discount for payment on the spot, you know, payment cash? I had to have a new bridge put in the other, 2 years ago. And because I was, my copay was pretty high. It was 50%, I believe, because most dental insurance will cover x-rays and cleanings, and it will give you a 50% discount on things like bridges or root canals. I said, if I pay you with a check, will you give me any kind of a discount versus a credit card? And they gave me an extra 5% off if I paid right away. Now, I was able to do that, luckily. Not everybody can.
Right.
If you've got, and again, they have these finance agencies right there who will work with you to pay it off by the month. But if you got to charge it, use a rewards credit card at the very least. Get something good out of it.
Definitely.
But again, healthcarebluebook.com and another one's called fairhealthconsumer.com. They let you check all the different medical specialties and see who in your area is charging more.
That's awesome. I had never heard of either of those resources, and so definitely hope people take advantage of them.
Yeah, I'm definitely jotting this right here in the show
and
notes.
They also, the site also tells you how to approach these people and say, the thing is they're basing, this is what, oh no, I think this is what they do. Dentist A knows that from Primera Health and Blue Cross Dental Insurance, he will get $1,000 to a root canal. So if you go to Dentist A and say, I don't have insurance, but I happen to know you get $1,000 from Primera, will you do my root canal for $1,000 cash on the barrel head? And some of them will say yes, because they don't have to file insurance. They don't have to fight with insurance. You're giving them $1,000 right up front, if you have it. Again, not everybody does, to do it. You can sometimes negotiate with these guys, is my point. And you might tell your listeners to look that up. Do look up articles. Look up Fair Health Consumer and Healthcare Blue Book, which I believe offers these strategies on their website. Look up articles on how to negotiate with doctors and dentists. And I know some people say we don't negotiate with terrorists, but go ahead and negotiate with the dentist. Because seriously, some of them would honestly rather have the cash in hand for sure rather than fight with an insurance company who says, I don't know, Marcus didn't really need Novocaine for that. We're not going to reimburse you for that. That sort of thing. Again, I know I'm off topic here, but this is one way people, they save all year and work real hard, and then they need $3,000 worth of dental care, and it all goes away.
Yeah. No, and this is good. I mean, any nuggets that help our listeners, things that come up surprisingly, that's what we're all about. And so, yeah, Marcus, get your note game up.
Yeah, I'm definitely imagining if someone's out there in pain right now, holding their tooth, listening to this show, and they're like, That's a thing. Like, yeah, mission accomplished. I'm very excited.
Now, I believe, let's see. See, I've written these books, and I can't even remember where everything is. But I have a section about how to find free, and it's in the first book, how to find free dental care or low-cost dental care, and how to find, oh, dear, where is it? That every year, the different states, they have free dental care for 3 days where all the doctors and dentists get together. And my sister does this in Seattle. She's a dental hygienist, where they spend 3 days in the kingdom doing care for free. There are links out there to find these things. And for starters, Google the name of your city and free dental care, and stuff should pop up. The same with healthcare. You know, you Google that. There's so much out there that people don't know about. For example, in Seattle, where I used to live, there was a food bank and social service agency place. And once a month, I think it was the Lions Club sponsored free health care. They had a couple doctors come in and examine people and take their blood pressure and check them out, and it was free. And it was, but you don't know about it unless you live near that place. So again, do free health care name of your city on Google, because maybe there's a Lions Care or a Rotary Club clinic in your area that you never heard of. And they will do things like take your blood pressure and send you out for inexpensive blood work and say, yeah, you do need blood pressure medication or that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I know we're ranging wildly here, but first thing you should do is look for it in your town, because you may not have to pay as much as you think you do for that dental care.
Got it.
Yeah, and I feel the need to clarify my own comment, although I think we've hit it pretty thoroughly here. It wasn't that he was suggesting that you not have an emergency savings fund. What he was saying is that he had a minimal savings fund and that he maximized his return. So he looked at investments where you can get 5-7% return as a better risk strategy than having, you know, 6 months of savings in a just a savings fund where you're probably earning 1-2%.
That is probably very smart, but a lot of us are not in a position to say, I'm going to put this in something that's not liquid, because I'm confident that I can cover the cost of something that happens. Because some of these things, if you cash them in, there's a penalty, right? Or you can't touch it for a year or whatever. If you have enough money set aside that you can do that, sure.
Yeah.
Like I'm not willing to carry a balance on my credit card. I'm just not. So I want more money in liquid funds in case I need it. I mean, I had a minor health issue earlier this year, and I'm on the hook for $900. Mm-hmm. That was my copay, and I thought, holy cow. I was not expecting that, and yikes. So I needed that $900 to be able to pay it, because I'm not willing to carry a balance. But if I had locked up everything except $500 in longer-term savings, then, yeah, I would have been in trouble there. Not in trouble, but I would have been frustrated.
Yeah.
And I think that's related here. So you have a quote that you don't need to give up things like having a pet, celebrating holidays or birthdays, taking vacations. And I think that's what a lot of people get intimidated by. Well, it's probably two things. One, all the things they have to give up, or two, how much they have to even do to get started. Thus, they do neither one. And so they just continue with the day to day. What do you mean by being super intentional, and how does that work or apply?
Well, that's why the subtitle of this book is Needs and Wants Edition. I don't think you have to give up wants to cover your needs. You just have to get smarter about how you meet them. For example, celebrating Christmas, for example, for people who, or any holiday. Can you name everything you got for Christmas last year? I can't. Because unless it's a really great gift, like an engagement ring or a puppy, most people can't really remember what they got, everything. So in other words, are we wildly overbuying for no reason? There's a lot of ways to cut back on spending and not be a Grinch at Christmas. And I cover that in the chapter about celebrating without breaking the bank. And because everybody, the holidays are fraught. Everybody wants to give great gifts and be thought of kindly. Nobody wants to be the Grinch, right? But especially for children, there's the three gift rule, which I think is wonderful. And if you start them when they're little, they'll grow up thinking that's the way it goes. The three gift rule is four gift rule. Four. Something you want, something you need, something to wear, something to read. So those are your four gifts. But the something to wear could be this amazing hoodie with your favorite sports team that you really wanted. And the kid is going to be overjoyed with that. And he's going to wear it all year and be happy with it versus giving him a bunch of little plastic toys that break and he forgets he even owns them. Something you want could be anything, obviously. Something you need could be, you know, you need new shoes. Well, mom got you the really good shoes that you were desperate to have, but you didn't think you'd ever get, the sports shoes or whatever. And something to read can be anything from a graphic novel to, you know, the collected works of Shakespeare. Mm. And so all those are great gifts, but they don't necessarily break the bank. I don't know what people spend on Christmas. I know that when you go to the National Retail Federation, they'll quote these amazing numbers like the average family spends $1,800 on gifts. And I think, holy cow, that's amazing. And it messes with people's heads a bit, but then when you think about it, do you want to spend the next 6 months paying for something that somebody forgot they gave you the next day?
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like that for a number of reasons. One, you know, it's pragmatic, so of course it works with my head the way I'm so logically oriented here. So, and then number two, and this will probably to the chagrin of my parents who are probably listening to this show, but to your point, of all the gifts that I've gotten over the years, and I usually got a lot of my parents were probably towards that 1800 side. They tried to do right by me in the early years there. I remember my gift because I got two this year, and they both contributed to my inebriation. I got cigars and a drink maker. So you're right. Yeah, it's only two, but here we are 7 months in the year, and I remember them fondly, and I'm still using both of them. But yeah. That being said, is the gift that I remember out of all those Christmases is the one that my parents contributed to, and I won't go into the full story because I've shared it on the show, but it was a remote control car. Rich is familiar with this story, but it kind of sustained without even realizing to get that type of budgeting. If I wanted this $500 remote control car, my parents were like, we'll put $200 towards it. I think they didn't think I'd like be even dedicated to it. And I was like, challenge accepted. And I worked, I worked my butt off for the next few months to save up for that remote control car. And even when I got it, I think I played with it three times. I think I painted it and I bought a couple. I think I spent more money on that car than I might have spent on this charger that I own now, you know, putting parts together for it. It was a very fancy car. But that gift sticks out to me, you know, had personal meaning. I was also invested in it. So I really like this four gift rule. And then had that been sustained, or I don't want to say trained, that sounds bad, but if that was, like you said, like if that's all you ever know, well, you get four gifts for Christmas, you just assume that's what Christmas is.
Well, they're four carefully chosen gifts, too, because right. He's so... I was at a relative's house, and he is raising his grandson because his daughter has a drug problem. And the little guy had so many that he'd opened about half of them, and he wanted to stop. I've never seen a kid do that before. And he wanted to play with a couple of them, and his grandmother kept saying, no, you need to open more of these. Come on, you got more to open. And he said, no more. He was overwhelmed. And I thought, that was a great idea. They wanted to treat him. They wanted to make his life better. Yeah. But half that stuff could have been returned for the cash, and they could have put in a college fund for him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's who are you giving these gifts for? And what point does a kid have too many toys? There's all kinds of ways you can do this. Another one is for birthday gifts. A lot of kids have too many toys already. Is let the kid, as the kid has a favorite cause. Say he's all about puppies. He might want to ask his friends to bring stuff for the no-kill animal shelter. You know, dog food and leashes and things such as that, toys. And then afterwards, they all deliver it to the shelter. Or I've heard of kids who say stuff for the food bank. Or you know, my church is supporting a village in Kenya. So if you want to bring money to donate to that would be better because then a toy I don't need. Now, obviously, every kid isn't going to be that selfless, but if you tell the kid who has a pet cause or a pet thing that's close to his heart, why don't we make this birthday about, you know, doing good for somebody else?
I like that.
Stuff for the shelter. I mean, if did you know that the Scouts, you can get a badge for homeless awareness? So if you've got a Girl Scout who just did that and is just indignant about the number of homeless in your community, just ask her, okay, well, I'll put your money where your mouth is. How about for this birthday, we ask your friends to bring shampoo and combs and toothpaste and stuff. I mean, that might be exactly what she wants to do. And then she gets to deliver it to the shelter and feel good about making a difference, even in a small way. And I know we're ranging far afield again in terms of one idea, but to rethink the holidays, what do you want out of them?
Right.
Is it about being with the people you love? And it also can be hard to get the rest of the family on board, because some of them will be angry that you're trying to change things. But if you're the one who makes the noise, there's probably other people who are silently saying, thank you, Marcus, for bringing this up. I'm being hammered by student loans, and my wife expecting her first child, and it's really hard sometimes to make the rent, but I still got to put on a big Christmas for this extended family. So maybe change the rule to gifts only to people under 18 or over 80, or everybody draws one name instead of bringing 50 gifts for everybody in the family. Or we set a charity and we all donate, or we pull names from the angel tree, or Toys for Tots, and we donate. Mm. Or we have a fun category like Best of the Dollar Store, or, you know, Best of the Yard Sale, and we bring these funny white elephant gifts in that some people might actually find kind of useful, but also funny. But you will also be maybe accused of being a Scrooge, but you... big holiday changes won't be any easier than any other big change. But it's you may have to say something. You know, focus on whatever the family, the holiday's supposed to be about. Love, family, you know. Go to a local free Christmas concert and listen to the music together, and or go out and make a snowman and then come in and have hot chocolate. Take a walk and look at the holiday decorations. You know, you can get creative and be careful with your spending and still make the holiday a great one.
I agree. And we're getting towards the wrap up here. Is there anything else that you want to plug? I think you've got a couple of things for the listeners. I have those in the show notes. If you don't have that memorized, that's perfectly fine. But social media, where the folks can find you?
Well, they can find me on Facebook under Surviving and Thriving. And let's see, I have a website. It's donnafriedman.com. That's F-R-E-E-D-M-A-N, donnafriedman.com. And I'm also offering, and this will be in the show notes, I'm offering the ebook editions, which are PDFs, of both books for $5 with a codes that will be in the show notes. So you can get either book for $5. And again, if you want that How to Save an Emergency Fund chapter, email me at survivingandthriving@live.com, and I will send it to you, and I will never put you on a mailing list or spam you. I used to be broke myself, and you'll read about that in the book. I was broke myself several times, and I understand how the difference of having a dollar and not having a dollar can make you feel very panicky. But you know the problem these days, and here I'm going up on a soapbox. When I was broke, I didn't have a credit card, because I couldn't get credit, because it was a while ago and a single mom couldn't get credit. Now, everybody has credit, it seems like, and if not credit, access to payday loans. So, you know how they say if your only tool is a hammer, all your problems start to look like nails? Hmm. Well, if your only tool is plastic, all your problems start to look chargeable. If you don't have credit, or if you don't allow yourself to just grab the credit card the first time something goes wrong, try to be more creative, and that's what this book's about, is how to power through issues without automatically going into debt.
Like
that thumping sound you hear is me getting down off my soapbox.
Yeah, no, it's all good. I was ready to help you up there. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great closing thought. And, you know, of course, it's definitely awesome to have you back on the podcast. And folks, make sure you definitely check out the show notes. And I think the discount code we're going to go with is Paychecks, I believe. But we'll
yeah,
have.
But there's another one, Balances, for the original. So, but it'll be on the show notes.
Got it.
That's great.
Perfect. Perfect. So, Marcus, anything else from you?
No, sir. Thanks for coming back on the show, Donna.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. So we were supposed to kind of stay on one topic for that one. I know we ended up covering a lot of different things, but the insight she dropped about the healthcare stuff, I'm really glad we talked about that, because I had never thought about those websites before.
Man, real talk, I might be negotiating some dental work in the next week. I'm going to be out there trying to get the hookup on the dental work, but the good hookup, because it is my mouth, pause. That was insightful. I really think we got some good things there. Hope the people got something and feel just as excited for us. If your tooth is hurting, get on those websites today. It'll be in the show notes.
Definitely get out there and cop the book. And if you don't want to cop the book, at least email her and get that free guide or free chapter that she was talking about. So definitely a lot of value to add. But as usual, we want to thank everyone for listening. Don't forget to join our email list where we share helpful stories we read throughout the week, actionable work and money tips, and more. And you can sign up by visiting paychecksandbalances.com/email.
And thanks to everyone for listening. If you have topics you'd like to hear us cover or thoughts you want to hear on an episode, you can email us at info@paychecksandbalances.com.
And so until next time, be safe. We out. Peace.